The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 26th of April, 2023. How are you keeping? I do hope you are very well, and I mean that genuinely, wherever you're listening to us across the Northwest, across the world. We want your views and input into the programme, 07491 25000. That's the number to call Caroline on. If you're outside the Republic, 00353 7491 25000. We've been contacted by quite a number of you, as we always are, over the last couple of days, chasing up issues on your behalf, making inquiries and so on and so forth. We'll give you updates on that stuff as the morning progresses. WhatsApps and texts come in to us, of course, on 086 6025000, 086 6025000, and your emails from anywhere in the world, comments@highlandradio.com. And just to remind you once again, you can watch the program on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. Like and subscribe if you don't mind, or across our Facebook pages, or directly in your browser on our website. If something piques your interest and you fancy seeing it instead of listening it, you can just click in to watch live, and lo and behold, there you are, through the wonders of modern technology. The Donegal Post reports this morning that hopes of a cinema for Donegal Town have been dashed following reports that the proposed site has been sold to Lidl. You might know, if you approach Donegal Town from the Ballybuffet end and you hit that roundabout, Lidl is off the second exit into your left. The site for the cinema was behind that. It appears Lidl has acquired that now. Mayor of Donegal Town, Park Kennedy, is bitterly disappointed by the news. He's one of the people who strongly supported local woman Yvonne Callaghan, a number of others who fought a tough campaign. They lobbied tirelessly for the necessary speed limit rezoning and other factors that would have allowed planning permission to be granted. You might remember we discussed it quite extensively on this programme. We always seem to get so far with these types of plans, and then here we are again with nothing, said Mr. Kennedy. We have been promised a cinema, a new library, a swimming pool, and all we have is more broken promises and disappointments there. The Finn Valley Voice this morning. Finn Harps Football Club have joined a national campaign to ship pre-loved sport shoes from Irish families to townships' children in South Africa. The In My Shoes campaign is working with schools, sports clubs and families to collect several thousands of no longer needed boots for shipping to the needy townships. Appeal co-founder and managing director Kieran McHugh said, shoes are more than just foot protection in an African township. They can be the difference between a hopeful or bleak future. Okay, fair play to everyone involved there. The Inish Times this morning tells us that a planning application for a greenway between Buncrana and Carindonagh could be submitted as early as 2025. The project to link the two towns, which is estimated to cost around £20 million. It'll probably be £200 million by the time we get there. But anyway, the project to link the two towns, which is estimated to cost around £20 million, is to form part of the proposed Inishowen Greenway. An approximately 120-kilometre loop around the peninsula. On to the Irish Times this morning. The top of the page, a very striking one. They have pictures of the 48 people who died during... Well, I'll read the article rather than trying to paraphrase it. After more than four decades of battling, the families of the 48... dared to hope yesterday that the beginning of the end of their fight for the truth had come. The long-awaited inquests into the deaths of their young loved ones, some of them children, at the Stardust nightclub in Artain, Dublin, in the early hours of February 14th, 1981, got underway amid scenes of raw emotion, and all of the victims pictured, as I say, at the top of the paper here. Hopefully this provides answers or a platform for people to move forward, but very sadly it's taken so long. There are those, and chief among them, people who drove the campaign to get to this point, who passed away before seeing it actually happening. Terribly sad altogether. Elsewhere in the front of that paper, the Fianna Fáil junior minister, Niall Collins, is facing calls to answer questions in the Dáil about his wife's purchase of property from Limerick County Council in 2008 amid increasing government nervousness about the controversy, as opposition TDs insist he had breached the law. Mr. Collins was part of a local area committee of the council that recommended disposal of the property in 2007 when he was a member of the local authority. After an open market process that concluded after he had ceased to be a member of the authority, the property was bought by his wife, who had previously approached the council about selling it prior to him leaving the council. And Mr. Collins had been sharply criticised for his apparent failure to declare his wife's interests in buying the property or recuse himself, in other words, step out from the meeting, from the local committee's recommendation. The allegations were first reported in the Ditch website, as we've referenced a number of times over the last week, an investigative news website. But he says he'll make a statement. He's done that before. He doesn't want questions and answers. And Leo Varadkar has jumped to his defence, saying that the Dáil is not a kangaroo court. But I think if there are very legitimate questions coming from numerous quarters, and if you've got nothing to hide, the questions are really quite simple. There's only a couple of them. You answer the questions, don't you? And then you draw a line under it and you move on. That would be the logical thing to do. Why anyone would not want to do that, I can't understand. Maybe you can. 086 60 25,000. But if it's there's a couple of simple timelines, a couple of simple things that need to be clarified, he answers those questions. Maybe they might be contained within his statement, and that puts it to bed. We have to wait and see what the statement is. The Irish Independent has bad news for some families out there. Borrowers are facing three more interest rate hikes as the European Central Bank's expected to keep the pressure on. Another three ECB rate rises mean the typical tracker mortgage holder will have seen annual repayments shoot up by more than 2,500 since last summer. Tomorrow week, the ECB is expected to announce a seventh rate rise with a hike of 0.5 percentage points possible, and two more increases after that could see ECB rates hit 4.5% by July from 3.5% at present. This according to analyst Justin Doyle at specialist bank Investec. Typical tracker interest rates have spiralled from just 1.15% in June last year to a 4.65 average at present. Now, there are those with certain types of companies that are paying way, way, way and above the 4.65 already. But reading on here, more hikes will also push up the cost of new fixed rates with more pressure on variables likely. Raising fixed rates will make it more difficult for first-time buyers to afford a home. We already know the challenges faced therein. Is it even possible now for average people to buy, about buy or build? Maybe it is. I don't know. It doesn't feel like that is to me. When you think of when I built my house, when you look at the mortgage versus my income, it was, what would it have been, four or five times? Something like that there. And people make this comparison, but don't factor in this inflationary element to it. So I can't remember what the exact figures were, but it probably would have been four times. Maybe five times, certainly four times what I told the bank, maybe five times in reality, if the truth be told, it was a long time ago, what the cost of the build was versus my annual income. Now, it's many multiples of it, probably 10 times, if you're lucky, maybe 8, 9, 10 times. And that's why it's so difficult now compared to when people of my age were trying to get on the property market. It was doable then. It's not, I don't think, really doable now. That being said, there are those with more knowledge of interest rates and what have you than I have that suggest that they might fall back. They'll never fall back, it seems, to where they were because they were artificially low, but they will fall back. So maybe people might choose to still sit on the variable. I don't know. Not everyone can switch to a fixed rate either, or it's not attractive for them to do so. On to any insight into that yourselves, please. 07491 25,000. Give Caroline a call. On to the Irish Daily Mail now. And Cabinet has approved referring the recommendations on how to change Ireland's abortion services to the Oireachtas Health Committee. Health Minister Stephen Donnelly received his ministerial colleagues' approval to refer the legislative proposals from the termination of pregnancy report to the committee and the operational proposals to the HSE's implementation group. Speaking to the media yesterday, Taoiseach and Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin said that the government had referred the report to the Oireachtas Committee, which would discuss the legislative proposals. Calling it an important report on his way into Cabinet, Mr Donnelly said, "It's certainly going to help me and the department and the HSE improve services for women right across the country." The review, led by Barrister Marie O'Shea, assessed the extent to which the new laws objectives have or have not been achieved and to make recommendations to address any barriers it found. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar indicated last week that he would be reluctant to make any major changes to the laws. He said, "When I went out and others went out to look for a yes vote, we said that there would be safeguards, and that included things like the waiting period, included things like the protection of conscientious objections, abortion laws liberalised following a 56% vote in favour in 2018 referendum have been the subject of a review as part of legislation introduced in the wake of that vote. At the moment, only 11 of Ireland's 19 maternity hospitals and units are providing full abortion services as legislated for. The report will be published in full today. And there's lots of different talk about getting rid of the three-day rule, which they say is an unnecessary barrier. Some suggest that's the case. That wasn't actually in the draft legislation, funny enough. That was introduced or added in afterwards. And also, I think some suggestions that, and this perhaps talks to the conscientious objection element of it, some talk of positively discriminating against in the hiring of pro-choice consultants in certain areas as well. Yeah, so we'll see how that plays out. The Sun this morning, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar claims his housing plan is working despite the need for a new €1 billion package of top-up measures in a desperate bid to ramp up house building. The Coalition's Housing for All strategy has yet to make a significant impact on the accommodation crisis. Instead, the number of people who are homeless is on the rise and there's a €1 billion underspend in the Department of Housing. Housing Minister Darren O'Brien, yesterday got approval to splash his €1 billion on three new additions to the Housing for All plan. Development levies that builders usually pay to councils have been suspended for the next 12 months. Now, what I find interesting in that is presumably the government then is going to use some of the money that they have that they can't seemingly spend without coming up with these ideas to give to councils, because that is going to leave a shortfall in council funds, presumably for very important spending. So is it a case of just suspending these levies or effectively paying them for the builders to the councils? I think that's an important piece of clarification for me anyway. This could save, on average, €12,650 per home and will cost the state around €308 million. So obviously, by those figures, they are presumably going to match that. Does anyone actually think, though, that building a house will become €12,650 cheaper? Or do you think contractors, builders will end up with an extra €12,650 in their pocket? But you know what? We'll build the house. I don't know. It's hoped this will convince developers to start construction on projects that already have planning permission. So what are they doing? Like, sitting twiddling their thumbs? I've nothing against, by the way, construction contractors or major big developers, right? Because I don't know enough to have anything against them. But what are they doing at the moment? Sitting twiddling their thumbs, not building anything, waiting for the government to put their hands in our pockets? I don't know. Well, the government also agreed to increase grants for people who are refurbishing a vacant property from 30 up to 50 grand and a derelict property from 50 up to 70,000. The third pillar is a new €750 million scheme that will kick off in July and will see the state give developers substantial subsidies to build apartment blocks that already have planning permission. So €750,000 of your money going into the pockets of developers to actually start building houses to make, they'll make money anyway. Okay, well anyway, as I say, I don't understand enough about it, but something stinks. The Irish Daily Mirror, the first Barbie doll with Down syndrome is on sale. Makers Mattel consulted with model Ellie Goldstein and the UK's National Down Syndrome Society on the design of the toy. Ellie, who's 21, said, "People need to see more people like me out there in the world. The new Barbie, available for pre-order from today, has a shorter frame and longer torso. Her face is rounder, her ears smaller, and she has almond-shaped eyes. After NDSS guidance, three chevrons on the doll's necklace represents three copies of the 21st chromosome instead of the usual two, which causes the characteristics associated with Down." Sorry, I beg your pardon. Some of these papers now are printed on, it's almost like grey paper. The paper looks grey and the writing is almost grey. It would be very uncomfortable for me to read a newspaper now if I was inclined to. And I don't particularly need glasses. But anyway, Carol Boyce, Chief Executive of the UK Down Syndrome Association, who welcomed the doll, said, "We often hear from families who feel their children are not represented enough." Lisa McKnight of Mattel said, "Our goal is to enable all children to see themselves in Barbie. The doll is part of Mattel's fashionistas line, Barbies with diverse skin tones, body types and disabilities." Now, as you can imagine, there are those who believe this is incredibly woke. Not necessarily the doll with Down syndrome, but having dolls of different races and different body shapes and what have you. Have you any particular views on this out there? Do you welcome it? 08660 25000 is the WhatsApp and text. RTE's Irish Eurovision bid was rocked last night by a row over transgender rights. Ireland's entry to next month's Songfest, Wild Youth, cut ties with the creative director in charge of their performance over online comments allegedly made by him. He tweeted them, for crying out loud. The band, consisting of... This is the problem with Ireland's laws in this country in terms of... And people wondered why certain stories aren't being published. You literally can't say anything on the radio or in a newspaper anymore unless you are absolutely 155% certain. And maybe this is a good thing because it's so easy for someone to make a complaint. And then you get tied up in legal stuff for months, years on end, and so on and so forth. But anyway, he made the allegations of the comments on Twitter because I saw them. But the group has parted ways with the creative director Ian Bannum just weeks before the semi-finals on May 9th, saying they do not want the choreographer near our team or Eurovision journey. A spokesperson for RTE also said Ian Bannum is no longer a member of the Ireland's Eurovision 2023 team. RTE won't be making any further comment, they say. The row has erupted after a series of Bannum's posts on transgender rights were highlighted by a social media watchdog group. Wild Youth singer Connor told fans he felt sick reading Bannum's online views relating to the issue. The online remarks range all the way to last year at least, and were discovered by the ESC Discord Twitter account, which describes itself as a Eurovision media outlet. In one, Bannum posted underneath a BBC news story about a trans woman convicted of attacking someone with a knife. He wrote, "It's a man. This clown world is ridiculous." In another, Bannum responded to a post by a trans person saying, "It's not a woman." Connor said, "First off, I want to apologise with my whole heart to anyone who has been hurt or even had to read such horrible tweets," he said. Now, Ian Bannum perhaps is guilty of saying perhaps what a lot of people are saying quietly. He said it out loud. So I don't know. He's going to hurt people with his comments. And Wild Youth and their song really is about acceptance, I suppose. So his comments, his views do not align with the band's. And he's out. He's out of that whole process. John Keane is the president of Macra Nefirma, and they have organised the Steps for Our Future demonstration. Protesters have walked through the night to arrive at government buildings at 1 o'clock later today. It's a 14-hour walk from Athy. Thank you very much for joining us, John.
Thank you very much, Greg. A pleasure, and good morning to all your listeners.
Are you on the walk currently, John?
As we speak, Greg, we're just after passing kilometre number 60, so apologies if there's background noise at any stage.
I'm just glad you can breathe and speak, John. Come here, what is the mood like and how many of you are taking part?
So the mood is good, the mood is upbeat, a few sore feet and a few hundred blister patches on at this stage, but the morale is still good. We left Athy last night at 7 p.m. We had over 100 people with us in Athy last night, and a core group of about 30 or 40 of us have walked through the night, and we've had numbers join us through the morning time as well. So all in all, about 150 or 160 people will have joined us at different stages during the walk. So a really, really, really enjoyable and tough at the same time, but I think we're getting our message across anyway.
John, before we talk about what you and your organisation feel needs to be done to, I suppose, secure a future for farming for young people, as it stands, what is the sense? Do you believe there is a farming industry, a farming future for new generations coming through now in this country?
Yeah, we do, Greg. We believe that there is a future. We're very optimistic about the future. We want our rural young people, we want a future in rural Ireland, and the young farmers want a future what's needed is, we feel, is the engagement around our issues to secure that future. I mean, we're positioned as a global leader in food production. Our family farm structure is something we're very proud of, that we sell right across the world. 99.7% of our farms in Ireland are family-owned, family-run, family labour on those farms. I mean, that's a unique selling point when you compare it to anybody anywhere else across the world. So I absolutely believe there is a future, and so do our members, but we need engagement, we need negotiation, and we need constructive dialogue to ensure that it's there.
What are the key changes that you think are required, or the key measures required to protect that future?
Yes, so at the moment, Greg, to paint a picture for your listeners, there's 6% of the active farming population under the age of 35. That's 1 in 16. So from a strong GA household like yourselves up there, that's 1 to 15 with everybody over the age of 65. That's what agriculture looks like. Your half forward line and your midfield, a third over the age of 65. You have only one person, your first sub, number 16, as the only person under the age of 35. And we feel that we need to get that figure changed. We need to get that statistic changed to get more young people into the sector, not just to drive the sector forward, but to implement the changes from an environment and from a sustainable point of view that we need to do.
But John, what is happening? Like, because presumably there are a lot of the older farming families out there that do have younger people in their lives. Is it that they don't want to hand the farm over at this point, that the younger people don't necessarily want a future in farming? They prefer to go travelling or to do something else? So, like, what is happening that has sort of stopped this rite of passage, almost this passing on the reins to a younger person?
Yes, excuse me, Greg. The big issue seems to be across many farms, with the older farmers in particular, the barrier is the financial security, or the lack thereof, when somebody passes on a farm. I mean, you have to put yourselves in the shoes, and we try and do it of the older farmer who's farmed for 40 or 50 years and invested their lives in it, and the financial security may not be there when they step back. You look at young people who want to step forward, there's barriers there in terms of access to finance and access to land. And that's why we've put forward and we've proposed an on-farm succession scheme that financially supports the older farmer to step back, supports them long-term for a scheme of over 5 years, but also at the same time you're supporting the young farmer through access to finance. And through that succession scheme, they're gaining access to land. And from a young farming point of view, from people in the sector, from people who wish to enter the sector, access to finance and access to land, or the lack thereof, have been identified as the two greatest barriers for young people to come forward.
All right, John. Let me just set up a scenario here, right? Say people in the fishing industry, they would suggest that they are being legislated out of fishing. And what we're seeing now is numbers of generations of young people saying there's no future in this industry for me, and they're taking up other roles. And effectively, what that could mean is that fishing just dies on its feet. And there are those that think that's happening in farming as well. Like, all of the measures that you are seeking to have introduced seem common sense, but it requires a will by government or a ethos of government to see a future in farming in this country. Or maybe that's another thing we sacrifice to the EU. Do you get where I'm coming from, John? Do you believe there is a commitment to the future of farming as is, and to enhance it within Irish governments? Or do you believe that we are effectively bowing to perhaps the European wish for us to move away from meat production and what have you?
Well, I think the pressure has come on from the European Union for that, and I think the legislation and the regulations that have come forward over the past number of years have almost legislated the opportunity out of the sector. We want to create opportunity to provide young people access. When we look at government, we look at the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, has assigned money for the cap funding for farmers across many different sectors. But we see a complete lack of ambition, or additional ambition, to support young farmers to step forward. When we see funding from a national level, if you look at the targeted agriculture support for improving your farm's infrastructure, we see that young farmers who avail of that now in certain sectors, if they avail of that and they're at a certain scale, they're going to be limited in their ability to grow over the next number of years. So there's many barriers, and legislation is one of the biggest issues in regulation. But we firmly believe that with engagement, constructive dialogue and negotiation, most importantly, we can create a future forward. That's what we need from the government.
What does that future look like? What does that future look like with, you know, the Green Party wanting fields, not with cattle on them, but with solar panels to re-wet large areas, the incredibly ambitious afforestation of the planting of trees and what have you. You know what I'm saying? On land,
yes.
Still big question marks over the size of the national herd. All the signs I'm looking at point towards farming as we know it not existing in a generation or two. How do you reverse all of those proposals, or how do they fit into your plan? Let me put it like that.
Yeah, so we've, I suppose, to deal with one of those, first the EU nature restoration, and we've put that forward as one of our biggest ambitions and aims to change and to influence. And you're right, that says that there's about 355,000 hectares of drained peatlands that needs to be re-wetted by 2050. We look at that from a community point of view across rural Ireland and the social and economic impact that that will have in every single community from the top of Donegal down to West Kerry, because that's the western seaboard that will be most affected by that. We think that common sense, logic, the future of rural Ireland needs to be protected by our rural independence, by our rural PDs, by those in opposition and by those in government. We don't think the fight is lost. We see opportunity. We see it in our members. But we need to see that negotiation. We need to see that engagement on these issues. And we need them to engage with us to provide a future for rural young people. And you're right. There is many things coming at us. But there's huge opportunity coming for us as well. Those diversification opportunities into other sectors are something that we've looked for into the future for our members to engage in, be that energy production, be that in alternative enterprises. But you need to see an economic return, you need to see an economic reward for that provided for within those sectors.
All right, John, so let me ask you then. So the next generations of farmers then accept that we aren't going to be farming the way we are now in terms of the amount of livestock we have, what they do, the type of work that farmers do. You're saying the generations coming through are happy to diversify and farm electricity and other things, farm wood instead of farming sheep and cattle, for example?
Well, I think the point around reducing numbers is something that we would have never said and something that we wouldn't put forward either. It's not something that we support. I'm talking about the diversification into energy production, the diversification into anaerobic production, diversification into the likes of organic sectors. But what's needed and what's not talked about in the context of those discussions is the economic reward. We hear loads of talk about the benefits of organics and it's many other sectors, and that's fantastic. Let's look at the continent, who are more developed in these in many areas from us, and we see the produce that are produced from some of those enterprises and in some of those sectors, from organics in particular, achieving the same price at market as conventional. So when we talk about diversifying, the key thing from our point of view and the message is you need an economic return and you need an economic reward. And that seems to be lost in the conversation at a government level. There seems to be a very clear lack of direction in terms of providing that economic return and economic reward for farmers, because ultimately that's what needs to be the farm.
John, finally, I'm outside the business, right? But there seems to be almost like a hierarchy within in farming. And correct me if I'm wrong, or guide me or educate me, right? Because if you're producing beef, everything seems to be against you and you're the worst in the world and you're responsible for effectively the world bursting into flames. But, and we saw figures coming out from the Kerrygold parent company today, they're making record profits. They are producing milk and cheese in this country, then shipping it all over the world. No one talks about the environmental impacts of that, the environmental consequences of producing product here and then shipping it to America, one of the biggest markets, etc. I'm not saying I'm against that, don't get me wrong, but that's lauded, that's fantastic, that's brilliant news. Do you get where I'm coming from? It seems to be if you can burn the planet in one area of farming and get a round of applause, yet if you're working a different area of farming, you're the worst in the world and you're responsible for the world ending almost. Do you see where I'm coming from? Is there anything to that?
I think that argument of the Irish farming population being responsible for the world stopping or for the burning of the world is not based in any real logic or is not based in any wholesome thought in terms of the world. So let's look at it from a global point of view. And we need to be proud that we're able to produce food here, one of the most efficiently in the world. So if you can produce something most efficiently in the world, why would you not be supporting that? Because the world will still need to eat. The world will still need food. And if we look at the, you know, what's thrown at farmers sometimes is the growth in the herd. Our national herd, even though there is no national herd, there's 137,000 family farms across the country. Our national herd, those numbers have remained static since the early 1980s. That's a fact. It's undeniable those numbers are the very same as they have been. And if we look at the developments in science, if we look at the pathway that's being charted forward for our sector, young farmers are engaging and implementing in those environmental measures that will benefit our sector. We want to engage with those. They're beneficial for the environment. They're beneficial for our future. But what's lacking from a policy point of view is the goalposts seem to be shifting every few months. If you look at the Common Agricultural Policy and the Minister's Mark Tours, he spoke about supporting every single family farm. You look at details then that come out within schemes within that, that is excluding some farms and defining some farms as not being family farms. So if you have 90 cows or if you have 20 suckler cows or if you have 41 or 2 head of cattle, under a minister's definition of average and typical, you're not a family farm. So what are you? We completely refute that, as the research shows us back done in 2020 by DCU, that 99.7% of our farms, family owned and family run. So from our point of view, this march is to demonstrate that we have a future. We need engagement. We need negotiation. We're going to be at government buildings from 1 o'clock today. We hope that as many TDs show up and meet us and hear our concerns and relay them and bring them back and implement them. And anybody who's around listening that wants to join us is more than welcome. And we look forward to seeing as many people there that want to be there in Merrion Square at 1 o'clock.
John, thanks for all your time. Safe travels. I appreciate it. John Keane, president of MACRA there, walking and talking. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. An emailer says, actually it's not, it's a texter. Hands up who's received an extortionate ESB bill, as if there were 20 people living in a house. Holy God, the government gives you free credit, by the way, and then charges ransom prices for taking it. Electric Ireland are the main sponsors of Darkness into Light, and here they are putting people from light into darkness. What do you think about that? I threw this out earlier in the week, seeing people getting huge bills, 800, 900, 1,000, 1,100. Now, thankfully, mine has stayed reasonably steady. It's ridiculous compared to where it was at, but reasonably steady. But I know an awful lot of people out there are getting huge bills, electricity bills. This caller is saying it feels like there's 20 people living in their houses. That's something you've come across. 086 60 25,000. This listener says, it's Ailish in fact, bus errand, booking seats on the bus. I booked and paid my return to Dublin Airport. One morning this week, I boarded the bus at Strabane at 7:45. I couldn't get the internet on my phone, so I told the driver I booked and paid. He wasn't going to let me on the bus as I didn't have the information to scan it. As I'm catching a plane and needed to be on the bus, I had to pay a single fare, and he said I could claim back from bus air. And this is a ridiculous situation. The stress and anger this has caused me. I'm a pensioner and not always okay on using the phone for this purpose. That comes in from Ailish, who hopefully now did make that seat. Ailish, it's a barcode, perhaps always best once you've actually just booked it to maybe take a screenshot is what I tend to do. So I have an offline version of it. Perhaps you shouldn't have to do it, but if you've no internet connection, what can you do there? But as I say, I would be inclined to maybe once you've booked, take a screenshot of the barcode and that should get you away. But still an inconvenience and having to pay twice for the one journey. And Charlie's on Facebook. He says, such strange weather in the last week. Here in Gwydor, the sun has been dancing in the sky for about 2 weeks. We went to Glenveagh on Monday and they had hailstones there. Letterkenny had some snow at the same time. Is the weather changing like Columbkill predicted? This county is different. You've got really high places where I'm sitting at the moment. You've got really low places. You've got places where the temperature is 6 or 7 degrees above everywhere else. You've got a massive hard frost in Letterkenny one day and the sun shining at the same time in 7 or 8 degrees in Malinhead. I don't know, Charlie, if that's what it's down to, our microclimates, but anyway, an interesting observation. Anyone agree or anyone have an opinion? Right, most of Northern Ireland schools are closed today due to a full day strike by teachers. For the first time, the National Association of Head Teachers is taking part, joining four teacher unions who staged a previous walkout on the 21st of February. With almost every teacher on strike, most schools have been unable to open. Dorothy McGinley is president of the INTO. It has 7,000 members in Northern Ireland, and they are, of course, amongst the five teaching unions on strike today. Hiya, Dorothy.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. And I presume you didn't take this decision lightly.
Absolutely not. I suppose from assuming my role as INTO president 2 weeks ago, I have been very, very busy. I suppose our focus now the last week or so has been on our strong 7,000 members in the north. Absolutely not, Greg. We did not take this lightly. We have been in industrial action now, short of strike, for the last couple of months. We've escalated our strike to a half-day strike on the 21st of February, and now we are out on a whole-day strike today, of which all five teacher unions right across the north are actually speaking on their feet and actually demonstrating by picketing outside schools and going to a rally in Belfast today. No, we did not take this lightly at all.
Pardon my ignorance, Dorothy. To whom are you protesting? Because there is no government as such in Northern Ireland. Is this a protest that you hope London takes note of? Or, like, who are you protesting to?
We're protesting, Greg. There are no politicians at the moment because they're actually caught up in any idiotic, I suppose, and point-scoring nonsense that's actually taking away from the real reality for teachers right across the north. So by us actually going out today, we're actually voting for our feet. We're actually trying to actually tell the politicians that we actually are actually serious about this. The fact that we have had pay stagnation for the last 12 years, mm-hmm. of squeezes of right above 25%, and also then.
Well, Dorothy, we'll get to the issues, but we'll get to the issues. But pardon my ignorance once again. To whom? Who can at this point, the way things are at the moment, who can accede to your demands, or who do you negotiate with at the moment? As I say, there isn't a Stormont government at the moment. And as I say, I'm not trying to catch anyone out, Dorothy. I don't understand here. Who could meet with the unions and meet their demands?
Our employers can meet with the unions, the education authorities can meet with the unions. We have been waiting for them to come back to us now for a couple of weeks. Our politicians can actually start to work and actually, you know, get Stormont up and running again. So yes, there is an education authority that we are trying to speak to, trying to negotiate with, but they have not come back with us mm-hmm. with any substantial pay offer that's actually worth.
And the education authority have that within their remit, that it's they that could meet the pay demands, for an example.
Absolutely. Okay. Education Authority in the North actually do have that remit.
Brilliant.
But they have chosen to ignore it, and they have chosen to abdicate their responsibilities at this moment in time. So as an INTO union, we're actually very, 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 very exercised about this, and we want to actually stand up and actually say to them, listen, you need to be talking to us, because that's the way forward in terms of our profession and in terms of valuing our educational system.
All right, we'll talk about a little bit about the pay demands, but this is also about education cuts, with which the union says having presumably a negative impact on children and young people and their education. What kind of cuts are we talking about, and how is that impacting young people?
I suppose, Craig, the Education Authority announced, and the Department of Education announced at the beginning of January, that the education sector had to find £300 million cuts between now and 2024. What's happening now in our schools is that we're getting weekly announcements in the last 3 weeks, for example, of the cuts of much needed services in terms of therapies, speech-language therapies, the breakfast clubs, the after-school clubs. The Engage programme that we had, which was an absolutely fantastic programme where teachers were providing remediation in both literacy and in numeracy for children who actually much needed it, is actually gone slashed. And this has a devastating effect, particularly on children in the Northwest, poor children who actually needed these services. So we are actually, day on day, we're actually getting so much cuts into our budgets that it's actually not sustainable. And I suppose principals and teachers are like are actually feeling this on a day-to-day, sir, on a day-to-day basis. On top of that, the wraparound services that was provided for children is actually now being slashed by 75% and will be diminished and gone in September. And I suppose this is going to have a knock-on effect for all the parents out there, all the children who are actually now obliged to pay for services that actually was provided by the educational services. And I suppose this is on top of the fact now that they are actually not valuing our educational system. Mm. We are perceived to have a very, 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 very strong top-class educational system here in the north of Ireland, but it's certainly not happening when we're actually getting cuts right across the board.
And what are the reasons behind these cuts? I mean, there's no new school buildings either for the next couple of years. Access to iPads and what have you being paused. You've mentioned other situations. I mean, is this because of a lack of a government in Northern Ireland, or is this across Britain and Northern Ireland that we're seeing these cuts in education, which it beggars belief to me. But anyway, with all the money that's being spent elsewhere and being sent elsewhere, have you been given any logic as to why education is being hit in the fashion that it is?
You will see that it's actually happening in England and Wales at the moment. We do not know what's actually why the reason being is that they're not valuing the educational profession, and that's what we would see as teachers. And yet, the problem then is that we have is when they're not valuing the educational system, we're actually having problems in recruiting teachers as a result because of the pay, and then of retaining teachers. So what's happening is because they're not valuing teachers in terms of pay, teachers are actually going elsewhere. For example, Greg, you may not be aware that there's a massive differentiation between pay in the north of Ireland and pay in the south. Their starting off teacher is actually getting 16,000 euro more actually in the south than they are in the north. And the same thing, there is a differentiation between pay in the south or in the north and also in Scotland. So they're not valuing us as an education. They're not valuing us as a profession. And so that's why we're actually not being able to retain our teachers, and we're not recruiting teachers because these teachers have actually have gotten into a lot of debt by actually going through third level educational systems, and they're not able to get jobs in here in the north. And on top of that, if they are able to get jobs, they're not able to get any sustainable jobs for any long period of time. Mm. So this is a real worry for INTO moving forward. We're not being valued as a profession. They're going elsewhere. And as a result of that, there's a breakdown in educational services. In fact, I would say that there's actual carnage in our schools at the moment. I suppose what they're trying to use is using slash and burn economics, and this is very, very worrying. The fact now that we have a brain drain of about devaluing our educational system and devaluing our profession.
Mm. And I mean, you know, whatever. And finally, Dorothy, whatever they say, people might have their different views about government and opposition in the Republic. But when 60 school buildings were frozen, it turned into a massive story here. Plenty of debate. Back and forth in the Dáil, and eventually that decision was reversed or adjusted to allow things to progress. One can't help but feel that if there were a functioning government in Northern Ireland, this would be getting far more traction, much more debate, far more media coverage, to the point whereby maybe money could be found to reverse some of this and maybe try and retain some of those teachers. It can't have no impact on it.
Absolutely, Craig. And if you look at the slash and burn economics that's actually going on in the UK at the moment, there are windfall taxes available. There is money in the economy. There is money in the economy to pay the teachers, pay the educational sector. And, you know, we've had windfall taxes, but they're choosing to ignore what's actually the most valuable asset that they could actually get, and that's the educational system.
I mean, there's no point talking about the There's no talking about the Brexit dividend for Northern Ireland, the best of both worlds, and all that kind of stuff. If we can't actually look after our children, none of it matters to me if we neglect our children, and I suppose neglect those that educate our children. Dorothy, where does this go from here? Very finally, in the last minute, this is a very significant day in terms of action in Northern Ireland. What's planned for the future if this doesn't bring the Education Board to the table?
Yeah, well, at the moment, I'm actually travelling here to Belfast. I was actually at rallies this morning outside a couple of schools. There is a noticeable difference that the roads are empty. So that's telling you that a lot of the 1,100 schools right across the north, from nursery, primary school, right up to secondary schools, are closed. I mean, there's 350,000 children being, you know, impacted today. But that disruption, I suppose, is what it is. But I suppose as a union, and with our sister unions, we're actually looking at the bigger picture. We're actually all attending a rally today. We've started it now to a full day strike. And we are waiting now for our employers, our education authority, to come and speak to us and actually put something on the table that we can actually negotiate with, and bring back valuing, you know, our educational system and valuing our teachers back to where it belongs.
Dorothy, thanks for your time this morning. And I should have said it at the start of the interview, congratulations on your appointment as president of the INTO. Thanks for joining us. A caller says, the report yesterday on Highland Radio about how Ireland is paying double the amount for electricity than our EU neighbours shows up this government for what they are, putting the profits of big business before the common good. It is really disgusting how, as people, we haven't a government to put our interests before companies' profits. It clearly is price gouging, and the people in power sit on their hands. That's what they think. What about the chemtrails in the sky, says this listener. Do people not know that the elite are messing with our climate, and then it's all about climate change, brainwashing people into believing it's all this climate nonsense? I've read the comment. I'd out of respect to you for texting it in, but I would love if you explained to me what you think's happening with the aeroplanes, because I just don't see how it all works. I mean, we see what goes into the airplanes. Are you saying that the airlines are all complicit in it? What are they pumping out? How is that affecting the environment? Did they purposely not make it rain in certain countries that need water? What's going on? Who's behind it all? Let me know. 086 60 25,000. News and obituary notices on the way.